Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
Okay, hello everybody, and welcome to the Embodiment Conference and our session today with Dr. Gemma Beckley. I'll be introducing Gemma in just a moment, but before I do, Gemma, actually would love it if any of you who are participating, remember this is a webinar format, so everybody's outside of the room that we, Gemma and I are in the webinar room. If you would like to come in and join Gemma, please just raise your hand and our tech host, Abby, will bring you in. And then towards the end, if you have questions, there'll be a little space for a Q&A session at the end. Just raise your hand and Abby will bring you in. So, Gemma, as a way to introduce your session, today Gemma is going to be speaking about an introduction to transcendental meditation. So let me just tell you a little bit about Dr. Gemma Beckley. She is an independent teacher of TM, Transcendental Meditation, having trained many thousands of people in the last 8 years. Having formally trained as a clinical psychologist with many years of experience working in the NHS, including teaching mindfulness, she is now full-time TM teacher for the registered UK charity Meditation Trust, who makes TM accessible and affordable for all. During Gemma's career, she has conducted research exploring the effect of TM on occupational stress and also on anxiety, depression, and well-being. Her training to teach the technique of transcendental meditation began with an introduction at the age of 6, it's an early start, followed by many years of intensive practice and advanced courses, culminating in several months of specific residential training in the methods laid down by Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. She has since taught TM privately to the general public, who are often experiencing high levels of stress with a range of physical and mental health problems, including anxiety, depression, and insomnia, plus people on the autistic spectrum and with diagnosis of ADHD, personality disorder, PTSD, and schizophrenia. She's also the director of the Trust's Charitable Projects, which is involved teaching children in care and in schools, both in the UK and in developing countries. Gemma, welcome to the Embodiment Conference.
Thank you, Miles. I'm really pleased to be here.
Yeah, it's very nice to have you. This is going to be a little bit more of an interview format, so maybe we'll just start at the beginning. I mean, you started at 6 years old. I think when meditation kind of came into the West, I suppose there was a lot of different traditions and methodologies that were coming, but TM seemed to strike a chord with Westerners in the late 60s, early 70s, it started to become quite popular. And I'm sure over the years it's evolved quite a bit from back in the counterculture days. I mean, obviously what you're doing is kind of in the mainstream. So I'd love to hear a little bit about you know, what is TM, how it started, and where we've come today.
Sure. So TM, well, TM is from an ancient Vedic tradition. It goes back 5,000 plus years to a time when the rishis of India were able to settle into deep levels of meditation and cognize the real meaning and purpose of life and also the origins of the universe. And They had many great insights and really saw life through a different lens, from a different level of perception. And this knowledge got passed down over the thousands of years, often or originally orally, and then eventually written down into many of the Vedic texts that people know of. Revivals of this knowledge has come and gone over the years. And the latest revival was when Maharishi Mahesh Yogi brought this knowledge to the West in about 1955. He came out of the Himalayas. He had received the teaching from his master, Swami Brahmananda Saraswati, who's known as Gurudev. He was one of the great masters of the Shankaracharya tradition in India. Maharishi took this knowledge, and he was one of the few around Gurudev at that time that spoke very good English. And his job, his mission, was to spread this teaching, revive this ancient Vedic knowledge, and to spread it around the world. He came out to southern India and then flew to the States, and then eventually, in his lifetime, did many world tours teaching transcendental meditation. Of course, he went on to train other teachers to teach in replace of him. And he set up a worldwide organization. Where we came to teach, I think I mentioned in the podcast that was recorded, of course, that my father trained with Maharishi and his organization, became independent in the 90s, and founded the Meditation Trust in 1999 to make TM accessible and affordable for everybody. So we are independent teachers, separate from any other organization. So I was introduced. Go on.
Can I just ask a quick question there? Because I have friends who grew up in the States, in Ohio, I'm sure you know the community, and they were a mainstream community, but they were really living a normal, American life, mainstream, typical American life. But the whole community was organized around TM. Did you also grow up in such a community, or were you guys more in a satellite or something?
No. Those communities were quite unique, you know. And the reason for those communities was that, you know, Maharishi had been organizing lots of research around the world, and he conducted, he had organized in a number of universities around the world throughout the 70s and 80s, research which showed a multitude of benefits of TM, scientific research which showed effects on both physical health and mental health on the individual. But the research also showed the effects on the environment of large groups of people meditating together. And he talked about the brainwave coherence effect. When we meditate on our own, as the research shows, we get a brainwave coherence in our individual brains. Coherence just means orderliness of the brain between left and right hemispheres, frontal and occipital lobes. When people practice in a group together, you see that brainwave coherence between everybody's brains, and it has a more powerful settling effect. And this actually in a group has a spillover effect, well, even as individuals, but as a group, obviously it's more powerful, has a spillover effect into the environment. So on the back of that research, you know, Maharishi was very keen to get large groups of people meditating together and to ultimately create world peace. They also showed research in war-torn areas of the effects of group practice of meditation.
And I think it was also crime in certain areas they would notice. So the community is kind of organized around TM meditation, and there's a communal coherence.
Yeah, absolutely.
That also, like you say, spills out into the environment or wherever the communal intention is directed towards. Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the reason for you know, people being keen to join those communities was to benefit from being in that bubble of coherence and to live amongst meditators and to experience those effects. Of course, we get effects as individuals.
Yeah, and it wasn't an ashram, just to be clear to people, at least the one in Ohio, it wasn't necessarily an ashram where you think, okay, everybody are kind of moving out of into an Eastern model. It was a very Western model, and they were just doing the practices.
And there was a university, and there's large community living together. But of course, we still get the benefits of meditation being as individuals, and there still is, you know, the more people that continue to to learn to meditate around the world, we're creating more and more of an effect globally. Unfortunately, yes, I didn't have the opportunity to grow up in such an environment. I grew up very much in a very mainstream British town where in the 80s, of course, you know, not many people, it wasn't generally in schools, and people were only really starting. Yeah, you're right, there was a kind of quite a surgence in the 60s and 70s, and unfortunately then it got associated with a bit of the hippie movement, and Maharishi was very keen to kind of
So that's what you went. So it's moved. It's evolved quite a bit from those days.
Yes.
And by the way, I think that you're more relatable for certainly for me, because I grew up in such a, you know, in Texas where I'm from. I also grew up very mainstream. I mainstream, and I assume many of the people watching this interview are gonna. It's very relatable. You know, your situation is more relatable to the average person. Mm. And so how has TM evolved from back in those days when it was counterculture?
Yeah, I mean, well, I think meditation in general, all types of meditation have in general become more popular in recent years. Now, unfortunately for me, in the 80s, you know, people were only really in the mainstream after the kind of surge in the 60s and 70s, and got associated with the hippies and things. And then it became kind of more scientific. But then really in the 80s, in the mainstream, people still sort of, you know, it sort of, I think it faded a bit then, and people sort of still saw it as a bit of all that hippie stuff. And people were only really starting to use the word yoga, and which was still a bit, I think, in lycra and leg warmers, you know, and they were only really starting to start the beginnings of yoga postures. So meditation really wasn't something that you sort of, you know, told your friends about. And so yes, in that kind of environment, I sort of went through phases of not really keeping it up. And so, but as it's developed over the years, I think, certainly I think in the last 10 years, the surgence of mindfulness has really helped meditation in general to become much more mainstream. Mindfulness, of course, I think that's helped where mindfulness has... some would disagree that it's helped, but I think it's helped become more mainstream, where mindfulness has separated a little bit from spiritual origins, where it became very clinical. As a psychologist 10 years ago, it became very normal for psychologists to start to integrate mindfulness into CBT and general clinical practice, and then became into schools. And so people started to use the word meditation a lot. And so that's really helped, I think, TM, because I find a lot of people come to learn TM have already done some mindfulness practice. You know, a lot of people tell me they've at least done some of the apps, the Calm app, the Headspace app, and so that's helped as a stepping stone. People often come saying, oh, I've done some mindfulness, I've done some practice on my own, but I really want to take it a step further. What I understand is that TM is a different form of meditation, that it's transcending, and I want to take my practice further and to try TM. And so the advent of mindfulness has really helped with that, I think.
Well, maybe that's a good segue, because you're clearly academically trained for mental health, I guess, as a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So mindfulness is also doing that. TM has been doing this even before mindfulness. TM was researching, was bringing in the science of meditation. What are the scientific benefits for doing meditation in general, perhaps, and then TM specifically?
Yeah, I mean, there's huge amounts of research now on meditation in general, but I think TM really led the way in the research department. Right back in the 70s, from the early 70s, they started to do physiological research on TM. Some of the earliest research was starting to show, as I said, the physiological benefits and the depth of rest that was gained during transcendental meditation. And they were able to take measures in the laboratory of things like the galvanic skin response and the heart rate and oxygen consumption and things, and showed that the level of rest that was gained during TM was particularly deep, even deeper than the level of rest that we were getting during sleep. And that happens, you know, very quickly after a few minutes of sitting down and closing your eyes and starting to practice, going into that a very deep state of rest. And then, of course, there is all the stress markers, the research which shows the effects on the body in terms of, you know, cortisol levels dropping. And you know, the research basically shows the effect that through dissolving the stress in the body, the nature's healing intelligence has woken up. We're basically re-establishing that mind-body connection, because stress is getting in the way of the communication between mind and body at its deep source. You know, the source of the mind-body connection is in transcendence. And when we transcend and dissolve stress, we re-establish the communication between mind and body, and all these benefits start to come through.
That was amazing. And I think you can say, would you say a little bit more about the source of mind-body connection is in transcendence? Could you just stop, double click that one and give us a little bit more? It's a beautiful, beautiful statement.
Yeah. So, yeah, in our perception of life is very different to how the rishis of India saw life. And particularly with the medical model, now we've seen our viewpoint is that mind is one thing, body is another thing. And obviously over the decades, we've looked at treating the mind or treating the body as two separate things. Obviously these days, we're much more familiar with the mind-body connection, and lots of people are talking about how to re-establish that connection. What the rishis of India were saying that was that essentially mind and body are one. They are just expressions, different vibrational expressions of pure consciousness, or what physics calls the unified field. There's an underlying source of unity, which is silent, unbounded, unchanging, beyond the field of relativity. And this has been shown in physics. You know, Einstein in the last years of his life started to talk about how underlying the four basic forces in physics, the strong force, the weak force, electromagnetism and gravity, there had to be one underlying unifying field. And that research and discussion and research in physics has gone on over the decades. This is the field of quantum physics, where they've shown how, you know, at a quantum level, there's a unified field where the field of duality can no longer be divided any further. You know, and this is what yogis were talking about all those thousands of years ago, and they called it the field of pure consciousness, or being, or the self.
Right, and that was from a deep mystical understanding, and we've kind of in the West here, or let's say in the modern world, West, East, it doesn't really matter, we've become disconnected from that.
Yeah.
That basic, really fundamental understanding, would you say, is to be discovered and transcendent, which I just, it's so beautiful. That quote. Can you say more about, you know, we've lost that connection. I think most people, certainly in the embodiment conference, will understand that, how it's just so easy to lose that connection. What's the downside of being disconnected from our deeper transcendent nature?
Well, disease, ultimately disease. Modern medicine has produced some amazing developments in how to heal the body. But modern medicine, all the developments that have been created and all the pharmaceutical drugs that have been manufactured, that they're amazing, and they can, you know, initiate some you know, great healing effects, and we wouldn't be without it. However, they are replications of what the body is naturally able to produce. The reason why a drug works is because it's replicating, as I say, what the body is actually able to produce. If the body couldn't produce that chemical naturally, we wouldn't have the receptors to receive it. The fact that it works means we must be able to produce it naturally, and we can. The body, you know, the rishis knew that the body has its own best internal pharmacy, and we can produce those drugs.
What's happened? What's happened?
The stress and strain of life. The stress and strain of life. You know, when the body accumulates stress, it distorts that the communication between mind and body. And the intelligence of the body. What the pharmaceutical drugs are missing is the underlying intelligence. You know, whilst a drug can be replicated, the intelligence of the body cannot be replicated. You know, we see this in, you know, that a drug is dependent on, you know, a doctor or somebody to prescribe, okay, give this amount at this time. But the body knows, the body can produce those chemicals in exactly the right quantity, in exactly the right place, and to be received by exactly the right place in the body. Now, let's say drugs have an overall effect on the body and just bombard the whole body with this drug, and it will go wherever, you know, we can't stop it going from to everywhere, which is why we get side effects and things. So we cannot reproduce, and I don't think we'll ever be able to reproduce the intelligence of the body, but only by reawakening it through transcending to that place where the mind and body are one and originate, and go back to that, tap into that intelligence in the body. And that's through clearing the way, clearing the stress out of the way. It's just the accumulation of stress. And anyone that's come to my talks or read my ebook and things will have read about how I explain stress and how many people are explaining stress now these days. Because historically, you know, for the last few decades, often people were referring to stress as an external event. And of course, you know, an event isn't the stress, you know, because we all respond to different events in different ways. And even as an individual, you know, the same event can happen to us and we can respond very differently. So the stress isn't in the event itself. We have a stress response, of course. You know, there's a great understanding these days about the fight flight response and how our body pulls all its resources together to most effectively allow us to fight or flee. And we know, you know, how the heart rate elevates and fats and sugars reach the blood and create energy and muscles tense and the digestive system shuts down and we don't want to waste energy where it's not needed, and changes in the brain and adrenaline and cortisol and the executive functions shutting down, the amygdala, emotion center of the brain, being on a heightened alert. And of course, you know, we all know that the fight flight response is a necessary response to have in certain situations. You know, when we're faced with, you know, life-threatening situation, we need to respond. However, again, we have an understanding of the nervous system more these days, and we understand about the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. Of course, how the fight-flight response is controlled by the sympathetic nervous system. But of course, we have the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the rest and recovery mode. And apparently, they say that historically, human beings were in the parasympathetic mode 99.9% of the time. And apparently.
Modern stressors kind of disconnect us from that. Science, in a way, medical science approaches it materialistically, which, you know, whatever. There are benefits to medical science, but there are also limitations. But it never kind of creates that, it's not designed to create that mind-body connection, to really bring the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system back together.
No. And of course, we shouldn't throw out modern medicine. You know, it's yeah, made some great discoveries, and we wouldn't be without it. You know, and it's really, we should be thinking of it as a, you know, it's very necessary in the current day when society has become so stressed. And we've really gone often we've gone past the point of prevention, and we're often presenting to medics in the emergency room because of that disconnection of mind body. We're not aware of the little signals of the body which are telling us that the body is not happy. And then, you know, we're getting signals every day, and many people, you know, sort of, we're so involved in activity and caught up in our everyday a stress and strain of everyday activity that we're not even aware of those signals that are coming to the body. So many people present to the medical profession at a point of crisis when it's turned into disease. And at that point, of course, you know, medication is very helpful, if not very necessary, at that point in time, to support the body in its emergency state of ill health. But we can heal, we can recover. And if we can, you know, just relieve the body of its stress, and when we transcend in transcendental meditation and experience that state of deep rest, it's the exact physiological opposite to how that stress was created. The body can't help but start to let that go. It's just waking up the natural healing intelligence of the body. You know, if you cut your finger, the
natural
body knows
repair.
Yeah.
The repair process naturally kicks in a way.
Yeah, exactly. So, we've forgotten how to rest and repair, to rest, ultimately. We've forgotten how to rest, how to really rest.
And the repair is an automatic, in a way, byproduct or function of deep rest.
Yeah, yeah. The greatest prescription the doctor ever gives is, you know, take some time off work, go and rest. But of course, we've forgotten how to rest. Now, what do? We put our feet up and watch some TV, read a book, but we've forgotten how to really rest. And through TM and transcendence, the process of transcendence gives the body spontaneously, automatically, naturally, also very easily, allows the body to experience that deep rest, which is, as I said, the exact physiological opposite to how that stress is created. You know, the founding father of the word stress, Hans Selye, back in the, whenever it was, 40s, who coined the word stress, when he saw the research on TM, said, yeah, I can see, you know, that your research is showing on TM that it is the exact physiological opposite to the stress that I've been describing. So the body can't help but then let it go. And it's a natural healing process takes place. And so that is reflected on all the research. Sorry, your original question was about the research. So of course, this gets reflected in an alleviation of all the effects of chronic stress. You know, of course, the long-term effects of stress when the body isn't able to rest and repair is, it's infinite. You know, the heart rate remains elevated and we get blood pressure problems. Fats and sugars start to clog the arteries. Digestive system doesn't work so well, and we can't think so clearly, and creativity is blocked, and fatigue accumulates, and sleep gets affected, and you know, every aspect of life, it impacts on mental health, anxiety, depression. Ultimately, if we're under extreme pressure and strain, and experience some traumatic event, of course, we experience the effects of trauma. So really, you know, stress is really the key cause of all underlying all our mental, physical health problems, and just general lack of well-being, and ultimately lack of expansion of consciousness, lack of higher states of consciousness,
right, and lack of coherence. Like you started with this whole thing, it brings us back into coherence where the mind and body are awake and aware, so to speak.
Yeah.
Listen, so there's a couple of questions that have come in on the chat. That would shift us more to the actual method. I mean, if you want to keep talking about the stress and the health benefits, that's completely fine. But if it's okay, and I also want to remind everybody who's with us on the call that if you want to come in, sit in the room here with Gemma and I, raise your hand, and our tech host Abby will bring you in. You're very welcome to come and join us. You're very welcome to come in and ask your question live as well. So Margaret Ann asks, how do you know when you are meditating?
My advice is seek a trained teacher. You know, it's really great that there are so many apps and things, and it's become so accessible for people to practice on their own at home, to follow some guidance that's online, and to follow somebody's voice or training program. But the best way to really know that you're meditating correctly is to go to an experienced teacher, because if you think about it, anything else that we do, we'd seek out a professional to guide us. You know, who want to fix the boiler or want to fix the car or want to learn a language or something. You know, we'd go to a qualified teacher who not only gives us the initial instruction. You know, receiving an instruction is one thing, but having a teacher on hand there. You know, with our courses, we offer free support and guidance for life. Come back to your teacher anytime. Discuss your experiences. Experiences change over time, and so there's always going to be ongoing questions about, oh, I'm experiencing this now. This is different to when I first learned. Is this right? What does this experience mean? Now, I mean, you know, it's a lifetime of changing experience. So even if you go to a teacher initially and take a course an important point of any an important part of any course or any instruction should be having a teacher to go back to discuss your ongoing experiences. As I said, it changes over time as stress dissolves and consciousness expands. All sorts of experiences come up. So really important to have a teacher to go back to and verify your experience and not only correct practice, well, mainly correct practice, but also, you know, to understand the experiences that are coming up. So that's my ultimate, you know, I couldn't really give any other advice apart from, you know, discuss it with a teacher.
Well, maybe you tell us a little bit about the method of TM and for those who might be interested.
Yeah, so the methods of TM. So when we teach TM, and this question has increased since COVID lockdown and things. Many people have asked us, can you teach TM online? You know, we're in lockdown, and we haven't reverted to teaching online because with the passing on of the TM instruction, that would really dilute it. And give a weaker version. With TM, it's really important to get face-to-face instruction, which starts with on the first day. The typical course is taught over 3 or 4 consecutive days, and the first day starts with a one-to-one personal instruction. And in that one-hour personal instruction, you receive a mantra or sound. In fact, we start with a very enjoyable traditional Vedic ceremony, which the participant, which the student, just stands and watch. You don't have to do anything. It's really a way of the teacher expressing gratitude to the tradition, which we described at the beginning there. So that just lasts a few minutes, and the student stands and watch. It gives a very good preparation for the teacher to pass on a mantra. So we have a selection of mantras which have been passed down through the tradition, mantras which are effective for transcending and also which are effective for householders rather than recluses, obviously. We select a mantra which is going to be most suitable for you and pass it on in that one-to-one instruction with an instruction how to use it properly. Now, TM is a very effortless technique. It comes from a different understanding to many approaches as to how the mind works. It basically works on the understanding that the nature of the mind is bliss. And when we talk about the nature of the mind being bliss, of course, many people say, how can that be? My mind isn't blissful. I don't experience bliss. And the yogis of India talked about the mind being Satchitananda, which means eternal bliss consciousness. And this is the underlying source of infinite creative intelligence that we talked about. It's a blissful state underlying the surface experience that we all have. So you may have heard this analogy of the mind being like an ocean. We experience like the ocean, the activity on the surface, and lots of thoughts and maybe distress and discomfort on the surface of life. But when you take a dive down in an ocean, the ocean becomes more and more settled until ultimately you reach a silent bed of the ocean. This is the same with our minds. All our minds have the ability to be active. We're all very familiar with the ability of our mind to be active, yet all our minds have the ability to be still. Now, if you can run, you can walk. If you can walk, you can stand. If you can stand, you can sit. So anyone whose mind has the ability to be active has the ability to be still. But also, very naturally, you know, the mind is only active because it's seeking something. And people often talk about the monkey mind. The mind's like a monkey leaping around in the trees. The monkey mind, as people often call it, is the mind flitting around, searching, ultimately searching for happiness. And we look to external experience constantly in our search for happiness. And we forget, of course, we have this misunderstanding or this as the yogis called it, pragyaprad, mistake of the intellect, that we are, you know, we are separate to everything else. And we've forgotten, you know, our connection with the source, with the self, and that the self is, it's in its quality, Satchitananda. And so, you know, if the mind is searching for happiness externally, it stands to reason that the mind is going to spontaneously go in the direction of the greatest happiness, the ultimate blissful happiness, which is actually the real nature of the mind, which is an internal state which lies at the silent level of the mind. So very naturally and effortlessly, the mind will settle down if given the opportunity. So when we give these mantras in TM and the instruction how to use it is very, very specific and very delicate in its effortlessness. It really, that's the key difference with TM as opposed to other types of meditation in its effortlessness of allowing the mind to transcend. We use mantras not in the same way as concentration techniques. We're not using the mantra as something to focus on and to try and stop our thoughts and to train our minds or to concentrate our minds. We're using the mantra as a vehicle for transcending. Actually, translated, the word mantra actually means mind, tool, or vehicle. It's a vehicle for transcending. And the instruction is given to effortlessly, you know, rest our attention in the mantra. There's a specific instruction which helps us to go through steps to grasp that concept. It allows the mind to effortlessly settle into silence. So even from that very first instruction on the first day, the participant, the student, is able to go home and practice meditating on their own. In fact, during that instruction, we leave them briefly on their own in the room to help them feel confident that actually, I don't even need a teacher in the room with me already within this first hour. So they go home and meditate on their own, and the next morning then come back the next day, come back over the next couple of consecutive days, two or three consecutive days, to build up their understanding of what they've learned. So it's not just about receiving a mantra and its basic instruction. You then have to really understand a whole wealth of understanding around it. We have three group meetings during the course, the first of which is talking about all the practical aspects of meditation. And people need to understand, all the questions that come up about, how should I be sitting? What happens if I'm interrupted? How long do I do it for? What time of day is best? How am I going to fit it into my everyday routine? Which is a big concern for many people when they first learn. How do I fit it into my busy lifestyle? We talk all about that kind of stuff. The second meeting goes into the mechanics of meditation and really gives a good understanding of the mind and the body, how it works, what transcendence is, what stress is, and how the whole process works and different experiences that we have. And then we have a final session which talks about the spiritual aspect of meditation and higher states of consciousness. And as I said, part of the course is free support and guidance for life. It's really important to be able to come back to a teacher over the next few weeks, next few months, next few years, and for a lifetime, to be able to come back and to talk about and to discuss experiences and continue to build up your knowledge of what you've learned. So it's really a lifetime course.
That's wonderful. You just answered a question that came up right now from Stephen, who said, could you give a brief general example of the instruction? So is there anything you want to elaborate on that? Or is that, I mean, that's, as you were saying it, it's in a way it answered the question that was coming up.
That's essentially the course structure. I don't think there's anything to add to that. Apart from the fact that you also have the opportunity to come on retreats, or you can even learn on retreats if you wish in the retreat environment, or learn in central London. And you also have the ability to come back on retreats to speed up your progress and learn advanced techniques in future as well, if you want to.
That might be helpful. Rachel asked a question that's kind of related to this. She says, it's a two-part question. The first one is, how is the TM different to other styles of meditation? The second one is, why does it typically cost so much? So you can take that or leave that. It's rather subjective.
Yeah.
But the first one is right on track with what we're speaking about now. How is TM different to other styles of meditation?
Yeah, so the best way that I can describe this is to refer to the research that was done a few years ago, where a couple of researchers looked at all the different research that had already been done on all different types of meditation, and they based on the technique and the brainwave effect that was happening, that was shown up in the research, they categorized meditation into three main categories. The first category identified was focused attention, and these are the concentration techniques. These are the techniques which most people think of as meditation. Now, the most common understanding of meditation is about it being concentration or controlling of the mind. And this is why all the pictures of meditation involve people sitting bolt upright in lotus position and hands in these concentration hand mudras. That's just one kind of meditation. And typically Zen Buddhist meditation falls into that category. often Vipassana falls into that category as well, although it's kind of between two categories, actually. But any technique which involves focusing the mind with the aim of keeping the mind steady through, through a focus or control of the mind. The second category of meditation, and just to point out, so how they identified that in the research was through the brainwave activity. And they showed people practicing these techniques had high frequency gamma activity. There's lots of spikes on the graph of this showing concentration, which is the same frequency you'd get if someone was doing a complex math task and you wired them up to an EEG machine. The second category of meditation they identified was open monitoring. And this is where lots of the mindfulness techniques come in. So open monitoring is where it's not focusing as in the same way as concentration techniques, but it's monitoring the content of our awareness. So a lot of Buddhist practices come into this category as well. The typical mindfulness practices that people are practicing from apps and things, mindfulness of breath, mindfulness of body, John Kabat-Zinn's work and all the stuff that's come since, typically falls into that category where we're monitoring the content of our awareness. We realize the mind's wandered off, we gently bring it back to what's often referred to as an anchor to present moment awareness. And these are the techniques that I was using and many psychologists are using when they integrate mindfulness with CBT. It's changing our relationship with our thoughts. It's more working on the level of thinking. So of course that fits very well with psychology, where psychology was traditionally looking at CBT and changing the content of our thoughts. So we're having negative thoughts or black and white thinking, all these kind of thought distortions. We looked at changing thoughts. Mindfulness came in where psychologists realized actually a very powerful aspect of that is that we're taking in analyzing our thoughts, we're taking a step back from our thoughts, we're taking a different perspective on our thoughts, we're changing the relationship. And so that's where the work of John Kabat-Zinn came in, and we started to use mindfulness techniques to change the relationship of our thinking, to be less identified with our thought. We're not our thoughts. We can observe them and let them go and not have to react to them, and so not end up in a depression or anxiety state. So that's mindfulness techniques, and again, different brainwave activity seen in those practices. Transcendental meditation was identified as being virtually unique in a category they called automatic self-transcending. And automatic self-transcending just means we're transcending the technique itself. In other words, we're using the mantra as a vehicle for transcending. We're not trying to hold on to it. It's a vehicle, which means it allows the mind to transcend, but we even lose the mantra in the process. So yes, the mantra disappearing is actually part of the process. In these analogies, we've often used this analogy of the ocean to explain the difference between these techniques. You know, concentration techniques can be like seen as like being in a boat and trying to steady the ocean. Mindfulness techniques can be seen as being in your boat and trying to keep the boat steady despite all the activity of the ocean. Transcending or transcendental meditation can be seen as taking a dive over the side of the boat. So it's a particularly effective technique for allowing the mind to transcend or to settle into silence. This is what's seen in the research in the brainwave activity. The activity that's seen is alpha wave activity permeating the whole brain, a quietness in the core of the brain, increased blood flow to the front of the brain, increased oxygen permeating the whole brain, and that important, as we said earlier, that brainwave coherence, that orderliness of the brain between left and right hemispheres, front and occipital lobes, which is indicative of a fourth state of consciousness or transcendence. Increased mindfulness or present moment awareness is one of the automatic results of regular transcendence. Because again, as we were kind of talking about at the beginning there, it's stress in the body which is causing us to be not present. You know, it's the stress in the body, the turbulence in the mind is a reflection of the stress in the body. As we spontaneously dissolve stress through the process of transcendence, mindfulness being more present is an automatic result. And one of the key differences, I think, again, I alluded to this earlier, but one of the key differences with TM is the degree of effortlessness, the degree of easiness. People are often very surprised, even when they've read about TM and how easy it is. They come along to learn, and they've practiced other techniques and are still surprised just how easy it is to transcend when given this particular technique. So yeah, those are the main differences. I will just answer that question that came up about TM being expensive. It depends where you go. Depends where you've looked. So do have a look at our website and our course fees. The point of the Meditation Trust being set up was to make TM accessible and affordable for everybody. And so particularly if you're in different countries, you know, you'll find different costs in different countries, and depending on who's teaching it. Certainly here in the UK, there's more than one organisation teaching TM. There's independent teachers. Around the world, you'll find teachers who are teaching from the same tradition. I have colleagues that are teaching Vedic meditation, which comes from, as the name suggests, the Vedic tradition, comes from the same tradition. And you'll find there are differing prices. And the aim of the Meditation Trust was to make TM accessible and affordable for everybody. So our principle at the end of the day is not to exclude anybody because they can't afford to learn. You know, it's price is never going to be a barrier. If somebody comes to us saying, I have absolutely no money at all, fine, come and learn. We do like that there is a tradition in the Vedic tradition, there is a tradition of exchange. You know, and I think in lots of traditions, lots of spiritual traditions, you know, even thousands of years ago, if you went to learn meditation from a yogi up in the Himalayas, you would bring him something. You wouldn't necessarily bring him money. You might bring him some clothing or some food or some water. You would bring an offering, you would bring something. And so the tradition of exchange is important. But we structure it so that, you know, we never turn anybody away.
Great. So listen, I think that you're uniquely situated as a mental health professional, as a psychologist. A question came up from Joanna Vasour, and it's about schizophrenia and so-called delusional thinking. And it reminds me of a famous quote from the American psychiatrist, Dr. Jack Engler, who is also a senior mindfulness meditation teacher. Already back in the 80s, he was recognizing that certain stages of our mental health, we need to be cautious. And his quote is, before you can become nobody, you could say before you transcend, before you become nobody, you have to be somebody. So I think he's referring to a basic kind of baseline psychological, an average neurosis rather than being on the psychosis scale. And the question from Joanna was, can you talk about this experience of mindfulness, she says, work with people living with schizophrenia and so-called delusional thinking?
Again, schizophrenia, even basically the understanding of all disease, as we talked about, is seen from this perspective as, you know, even in mental health, yeah, you know, we've really separated mind and body in talking about mental health and physical health, and obviously with that has come a lot of stigma about mental health. But it's still a reflection of stress in the body, no matter how extreme the mental experience. You know, again, the yogis of India told us that the natural state of the mind is Satchitananda. Any disturbance in the mind it's not a problem with the mind. It's a very different way of thinking to modern psychiatry. But it's not so much a disturbance in the mind as a reflection of the disturbance in the body. It's experience in the mind, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's very much experience. So it is useful to, you know, to categorize and distinguish mental and physical health. But it is it is a reflection of the body. If we can start to heal the body and re-establish the communication between mind and body, ultimately any aspect of disease can be healed. Now, and it comes out obviously differently in different people. It depends on our genetics and our predispositions and our body type. We're all prone to different disease, whether it's a physical disease, a heart problem, or a mental health problem such as schizophrenia or depression. We're all prone to different manifestations of that stress.
Would you teach the TM method to somebody with schizophrenia?
I have done. But importantly, what we would do is just to talk to the person first to get an understanding of their level of stability. It's the same with schizophrenia or PTSD or extreme drug use. You know, we do ask people questions before they learn about their degree of stability. And if somebody was in an acute state of distress, then, you know, no, we wouldn't just teach them TM and off they go. We would, if somebody was suffering very acutely and experiencing a lot of ongoing everyday disturbance, then we would recommend starting with the body. Well, actually, as we know, physically starting with the body in terms of yoga postures, even pranayama, because that's a gentler way to start. By yoga postures, a physical aspect, and mindfully, again, it's bringing in this mindfulness aspect, starting with mindfulness, bringing our mindful awareness to the body as we practice yoga postures, really, again, embodiment, you know, bringing our awareness back to the body, really, you know, establishing on that level the communication with mind and body, and helping stress to start to release, and then, practicing yoga postures, sometime working on the body, and then perhaps bringing in some pranayama, and then once we feel some more stability, when we're ready to move on to TM. But you know, just also to point out, having a particular diagnosis does not exclude somebody from starting TM straight away. You know, somebody could have been given a diagnosis of schizophrenia 10, 15 years ago and been stable for many years. Now, they may have done lots of yoga and been on some medications which have stabilized them, and you know, could be ready to start TM in the ordinary way. So in that case,
working with a qualified instructor / maybe even therapist is essential.
Absolutely. Yeah, really important to work with somebody and to assess your readiness. And then assess your readiness over time, you know, because the process can also be adapted. If somebody starts to learn to meditate with us and experience some discomfort, sometimes some discomfort can come up, as I'm sure you know, during meditation, as stress releases, it's possible to get a flavor of the quality of stress that's being released. And so for some people, 20 minutes, well, we practice TM for 20 minutes twice a day. For some people, that's just too much for their physiology. Well, not too much. You know, you can't ever release too much stress, but you can release too much for comfort. So we want to take it gradually. For most people, we start with 20 minutes twice a day for most people, because that's what the average person finds very comfortable. They're able to integrate that into their everyday lives, go off to work and have no disturbance at all. Then they're not aware of stress releasing. It's a very gentle, gradual process, and it integrates nicely into their day. For somebody who's been experiencing a lot of turbulence and distress, particularly emotionally, the body may be very keen to let go of that stress, and we just need to take it a bit more gently with those people. So as I say, you discuss it with the teacher before you learn, just to ensure that you're ready to dive straight into the course, but we can adjust it accordingly. And even if they are ready to learn, we may start them on less amount of time meditating and adjust accordingly throughout the course and throughout their ongoing experience.
Great. So we really only have a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about, because I understand you work with children as well. You know, not adults who've been through a lifetime of stress, and we're kind of unwinding all that. But you started at an early age, and you know, that's we only have just a couple of minutes. But could you just say something interesting about? I'm sure it'll be interesting, but something relevant about that.
Sorry. Yeah. So you mentioned that I learned at the age of six. We can teach children from the age of six a children's technique. They practice slightly differently. They practice with their eyes open for as many minutes as their age. They have their physiologies are a bit more delicate, and so we start in that way. But from the age of 10, children learn in exactly the same way as adults do. They come on the course and they still practice for as many minutes as their age. So a 10-year-old do 10 minutes, and they increase each year of their life by one more minute. Children can learn, and this is testament to the effortlessness of the technique. Now, in fact, interestingly, children find it even easier than adults do, because adults come with all their preconceptions and ideas about what meditation is. They come feeling they already know, They already know how to meditate, or they've heard about it, and you know, and you have to put effort in, and you have to do that, you know, and so it's very difficult to leave that at the door. So at the age of 10, that innocence is still there, and it's beautiful because they just, you know, transcend spontaneously. And why do we need to sit and talk about it? But the best way for children to learn is for it to be in the school system. And I'd really, you know, obviously mindfulness is coming more and more into the school system. I'd love for TM to you know, there are some schools that have some TM practice, but you know, meditation, and particularly, you know, from my perspective, transcendental meditation should be mainstream. Children should be learning. You know, we know the emotional problems that children and young people are experiencing these days. It's there's a lot of emotional difficulty that young people are experiencing, so we really should be getting it into schools and into the curriculum and establishing that routine from that early age. It should be part of our day, like brushing our teeth, like taking a shower in the morning. By the time we get to adults, people are saying, how can I fit this into my routine? Or how do you fit having a shower into your routine?
You know, the beautiful thing about meditation in general and TM as well, all times, all places, and all circumstances. You can, I mean, of course, we want to retreat or let's say seclude ourselves for the 20 minutes or whatever it may be, but also you can activate it, or you can practice it all times, all places, and all circumstances. There's really no limitations to what we can do with this practice.
Oh,
I'm curious about the children. Is your approach different? Because we still have a couple of minutes. Is your approach different working with children than it would be with normal stressed out adults?
Well, no, only in that, as I say, children will find it even easier from that very first instruction. And yeah, we wouldn't go into as lengthy explanation if we teach a course purely for children. Now we'd keep it, a bit simpler maybe. But yeah, parents are sometimes concerned, oh, will my child be able to take in all this information and, you know, practice? Is it accessible for my child? Absolutely, they can come on an adult course. But if I was teaching, when I have taught in schools, I've just only adapted it in terms of just making it a bit more, the language a bit more accessible and a bit briefer and things. But otherwise, no, the teaching is the same.
That's fantastic. Listen, we've kind of come to the end. I have a couple of announcements. There's some nice comments here. Margaret says, thank you very much. This has been a amazing and fascinating conversation. And if you guys want to share your feedback in the chat, Jim can check that out while I'm giving these final announcements. And after announcements, Jim, I'm going to come back to you for the final word. And if you could also give us your top tip for meditation and embodiment, that would be wonderful. So let me just make some final announcements. I've posted what I'm about to say in the chat, so the links are there. Jim is teaching regularly in the UK, as she said, in London and around the UK. She also has a free ebook that you can download on her website. For this and more information about Jim and Beckley, please go to www.meditationtrust.com. It's in the chat. Our next session will be in 1 hour from now. It's with Dr. Tamara Russell, and her session is, What Does Embodiment Really Mean? And I'd like to remind everybody that the Embodiment Conference has on the off hour, there are the coffee room, Zoom room, the coffee break Zoom rooms that you can go to and really unpack the session. You know, we're receiving, it's almost like we're drinking at the fire hose here. You know, it's really a lot of information that's coming in, and we need to debrief and unpack what's going on. If you've got friends around you that you can do that, wonderful. Get away from the screen and just definitely go do that. But if you'd like to connect with people from around the world, join the coffee break Zoom rooms. The link is also in the chat. And you'll find it in the portal if you need to go. If you're not reading the chat, just go to your portal and you'll find it there. Also, the Embodiment Conference has a Facebook group. Something close to 40,000 people joined up that Facebook group. Please go over there. It's the Facebook groups, facebook.com/groups/Embodiment Conference. And the whole community is over there raving about the sessions that they are joining in this conference. Finally, this session has been recorded. It will be available for free.
Oh, and I think we've lost Miles. Oh,
I'm sorry about that. What was the last thing you heard me say? I'll say it again. This session has been recorded. It is available for free to watch the replay for the next 48 hours. Definitely come back and receive some of Dr. Gemma's wisdom. But if you're interested in the package, this has been a labor of love and a considerable amount of resources to put together the amazing staff and this production of the Embodiment Conference. For those who'd be interested in owning the library of all these different sessions, you can purchase that. Please definitely go to the portal, embodimentconference.com. You'll find a way to access the libraries if you're interested. Investing in the libraries actually supports the production of this amazing global, free, and local event, as well as investing in yourself. Dr. Gemma, would you like to give us your top tip and final words?
My top tip: invest in yourself. Yourself is the most important thing you have in this lifetime. Invest in yourself. Find a qualified teacher who can instruct you in correct practice and that can guide you for the rest of your life through correct practice and through your experiences. And, you know, take that step, make that investment, and do it. Find a way to fit it into your day. You know, nobody is too busy. If you're too busy to meditate, you're too busy, as a wise person once said. So yeah, invest.
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Gemma, and thanks for everybody for joining this session, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you both. That was wonderful. I really like that.
Yeah, me too. Thank you, Yolanda. Thank you, Abby. Thank you.